Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram weekend edition for Saturday, October 19th, 2024. CASA event urges involvement as Texas foster care system set to change. Powerful stories were shared and community involvement was urged at CASA of West Texas Full Circle event. Full Circle, held Friday at Bush Convention Center, focuses on child welfare and lived experience training. It featured a panel session that included former youth who have experienced the child welfare system firsthand. The event aimed to bring lived experience experts to share their stories while advocating for change. One of the facilitators of the event was Alicia Broerman. Broerman described her detrimental experience while in the foster care system, including multiple placements and adoptions. She also recounted the dehumanizing treatment she endured as a child within the system. Quote, "I went through several different placements. I was adopted two separate times. And through the system, every single time I moved from home to home, I was handed trash bag after trash bag to pack my things to move to the next placement," end quote. She recounted during an interview with the Reporter Telegram, quote, "There are a lot of things within the system that need to be changed, which is why, hence our CASA topic this year is the power of change," end quote. Broerman emphasized the importance of listening to those who have lived through the system. She also shared her unique story of being adopted at the age of 16. While the target audience for CASA's event included lawyers, judges, social workers, CASA advocates, and teachers, Broerman stressed the desire for the event to expand to involve legislators in discussing how certain policies affect foster youth. Quote, "The second thing I would mention is not feeling heard or seen as a child," end quote, she explained. Quote, "And when we are not seen, we are not heard, and we are not validated. It puts us back into that survival mode state, and then our story isn't told." That's a big part of why the system has implemented policies that are not working, because they are not listening to the individuals who have lived through the experience themselves, end quote. CASA of West Texas Executive Director Patty Pisklock discuss the upcoming privatization of the foster care system and its implications for the future of foster care. Pisklock said Child Protective Services, CPS, will focus on investigations while private entities will handle other services like family-based safety services and licensing. Quote, "It's a contractor that will come in and they will enforce all the other areas that Child Protective Services used to do, like family-based safety services, conservatorship when children are in foster care, and the licensing for families," end quote, she said. Quote, "So that will be under an agency as opposed to the state of Texas," end quote. Pisklock said the hope is to bring foster children closer to home and to provide services that are closer to home as well. However, she was hesitant about the privatization because of a concern about the lack of services. Quote, "When there's a lack of services in the area and things like that, it can be tricky," end quote, she said. Quote, "It can be difficult to do, so that's one of the things that we are facing," end quote. Pisklock emphasized community involvement as the key ingredient to making the privatization of the foster care system successful and improving the system. Quote, "I think there's a chance for positive change if the community gets involved," end quote, she said. Quote, "If we can engage the community as best we can and provide that education to them, you may not be able to become a foster parent or an adoptive parent, but you can help," end quote. CASA reported that in seven West Texas counties, close to 270 children were in foster care. For more information on becoming a volunteer, please visit CASAWTX.org. Texas unemployment rates drop as schools reopen, businesses resume. All of the Texas Workforce Commission's 26 Metropolitan Statistical Areas, MSAs, saw lower unemployment rates in September as schools started the new school year and businesses returned to normal after summer breaks. The commission said Friday its Midland MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, fell to 2.6% from 2.8% in August, but is above the 2.4% recorded last September. Still, Midland continues to report the state's lowest unemployment, followed by Amarillo at 3% and College Station Bryan at 3.2%. Abilene, Austin Round Rock, and Lubbock each reported 3.4% unemployment. Odessa saw its rate fall to 3.6% from 3.9% in August. Quote, this area is doing well. Just get on the highway, end quote. Willie Taylor, CEO of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin, told the Reporter-Telegram. Quote, even the airport. Reporting over 700,000 boardings, end quote. Taylor said the region's labor market strength remains stable, or as he put it, quote, same old song, different month, end quote. He said he does have concerns about meeting workforce in critical areas like education, healthcare, law enforcement, oil and gas, even information technology. Quote, we need to do a better job of marketing these jobs to our kids, end quote, he said. But he said he is pleased both Midland and Odessa passed school bonds last year, signaling their willingness to invest in the long-term future of the workforce. Quote, for those folks who want to get into the workforce and need childcare, contact the local workforce center, end quote. Midland's civilian labor force continued to expand, rising almost 700 to 118,300 from 117,674 in August and 2,559 from 115,741 last September. The number of employed Midlanders rose about 800 to 115,181 from 114,326 in August and 2,258 from 112,923 employed a year ago. The number of unemployed fell to 3,119 from 3,348 in August, but is about 300 more than the 2,818 unemployed last year. Midland added 800 jobs from August to September, led by a 400 job gain in the government sector. Mining, logging, and construction added 200 jobs over the month. The trade, transportation, and utilities sector, the professional and business services sector, and private education and health services sector each added 100 jobs. Leisure and hospitality was the only sector to lose jobs, down 100 for the month. For the 12 months from September 2023 to September 2024, Midland added 1,500 jobs for a 1.2% growth rate. Mining, logging, and construction and the private education and health service sectors led with 400 new jobs each. Trade, transportation, and utilities created 300 new jobs. Manufacturing, the financial activities, the professional and business services, the other services, and the government sector each grew by 100 jobs. Leisure and hospitality lost 100 jobs, the only sector to decline over the year. Statewide, the unemployment was 4.1% as the labor market set new records for job count and number of people in the civilian labor force. Texas seasonally adjusted total non-farm employment increased to 14,289,900 after 29,200 jobs were added over the month. Texas added 327,400 jobs from September 2023 to September 2024. In September, Texas' seasonally adjusted civilian labor force achieved a new record high of 15,449,900 after adding 51,500 people over the month, the ninth consecutive month of growth in the civilian labor force. Over the year, 318,500 have joined the state's labor force. While Midland reported the state's lowest unemployment, the highest was McAllen-Edinburgh Mission at 5.9%. Family Support Center expansion connects families, students with resources. The Midland ISD Family Support Center, with the help of Tasha Stevens and Vanessa Zayas, offers food, hygiene, clothing, and resources for families, employees, and students of MISD. Recently, the Support Center hosted a grand opening celebration at an additional facility that will house a food pantry, hygiene pantry, clothing supply, and more. The new facility is located at 2101 East and Indiana Avenue, behind the Young Women's Leadership Academy in Midland. Programs at the center include the Hunger and Hygiene Heroes, Books and Buddies, Jeans for Teens, and a car seat program for teen moms. This year, MISD officials say that the center has served more than 3,800 individuals this fiscal year, with a total of over 12,000 served last year. Stevens described the day as a major step forward for the families they help. That they help assist. Quote, it's a very monumental moment that we've worked hard to get to, end quote, she told the Reporter Telegram. Quote, we are very passionate about our students and families that we serve, and we are excited about the future and what else we can bring to them in need, end quote. Currently, the MISD Family Support Center operates on grants and drives with multiple campus involvement in donating items like food, hygiene products, as well as school supplies. Stevens said that volunteers are always welcome as the center relies on a village to serve families effectively. Zayas said that since 2020, the center has grown significantly. Quote, the expansion allows for more family engagement and classes, end quote, she said, while also noting that the center collaborates with other nonprofits and relies heavily on volunteers. The hours of operation for the center are listed below. For more information, visit the Family Support Center's website. Hours of operation, no appointment needed, Monday to Tuesday, 8 to noon, Wednesday to Thursday, 1 to 5 p.m. Private appointments, Monday and Tuesday, 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., Wednesday to Thursday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Two earthquakes over 3.0 magnitude hit near Midland. A pair of earthquakes greater than 3.0 magnitude struck within minutes of each other, about 30 miles north of Midland, on Friday. The U.S. Geological Survey recorded a 3.4 magnitude quake at 1:25 p.m., and a 3.1 followed at 1:34 p.m. The area is the site of a 5.1 magnitude tremor that struck September 16th. According to USGS data, the area has seen 10 earthquakes of all magnitudes over the past 7 days and about 60 over the past 30 days, with most being under 2.0 magnitude. From roughly Culberson County in the west to Scurry County in the east, USGS data shows about 500 earthquakes over the past 30 days. The largest was a 3.8 magnitude tremor on September 26th, about 25 miles northwest of Toya, with a 3.7 magnitude quake happening in the area a day earlier. Midland sees rig increase amid Texas drilling decline. Drilling activity remains within its narrow band, falling slightly for the fourth time in 5 weeks. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes said Friday its U.S. rig count was down one rig to 585 for the week. That's 39 rigs, or 6% below the 624 reported last year. The number of rigs drilling for crude oil was up one rig to 482 rigs, still down 20 from 502 the previous year. The number of rigs seeking natural gas was down by 2 to 99 rigs, 19 fewer rigs than the 118 drilling for natural gas a year ago. Texas followed the national trend, dropping 2 rigs for 283 rigs active in the state, down 25 from 308 a year ago. Texas was the only state to see a decline. New Mexico was unchanged at 99 rigs. Colorado 1 and Oklahoma 1 were the only producing states to see an increase. The Permian Basin was unchanged at 304 rigs, down 8 from 312 last October. Lee County, New Mexico, continues to be the most active county in the Permian, reporting 49 rigs for a third week. Eddy County, New Mexico, was unchanged with 47 rigs. Martin County was home to 31 rigs for a fourth week. Midland County saw the biggest increase, rising 2 rigs for 26 at work within county lines. Right behind was Reeves County, reporting 25 rigs for a second week, and Loving County with 24 rigs for a second week. Upton County saw 14 rigs, Reagan County had 13 rigs for a second week, and Ward County had 12 rigs for a second week. Howard County posted the steepest decline, losing 3 rigs for 7 this week. Crockett County saw no activity, losing its 1 rig. Scurry County saw new activity with 2 rigs going to work in the county. energy-dedicated software-as-a-service firm Enverus said its U.S. rig count for the week ended October 11th fell 6 rigs to 596 and is down 39 rigs, or 6%, from the previous year. The number of rigs drilling for oil fell 7 rigs to 159 and is down 207 rigs, or 56%, from last October. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas was down 2 rigs to 84 and is down 69 rigs, or 45%, from 154 a year earlier. ExxonMobil remains at the top of the 10 most active operators by rig count, falling 1 rig to 36. ConocoPhillips was unchanged at 28 rigs, and Occidental Petroleum was down 1 rig to 28. Enverus Permian rig count was down 5 rigs to 291 rigs, and is down 19 rigs, or 6%, from 310 last October. The most active play, the Delaware, reported 169 rigs, down 2 for the week, and down 7 rigs, or 4%, from 176 a year ago. The Midland Basin lost 3 rigs to 103, down 13 rigs, or 11%, from 116 a year ago. Looking at trailing 30-day drilling permits, the Permian Basin had 779 permits as of the week ended September 27th, down from 812 the previous week, but above 742 a year earlier. The Permian had 120 frac crews as of the week ended September 27th, down from 123 the previous week and 155 a year ago. Oil prices dropped below $70 per barrel on easing Israel-Iran concerns. A combination of receding concerns Israel will attack Iranian oil facilities and rising concerns over the strength of Chinese oil demand sent oil prices tumbling this week. Prices posted their biggest decline in over a year. West Texas Intermediate fell 4 or 5 trading days on the New York Mercantile Exchange, highlighted by a $3.25 tumble Wednesday. Prices eked out a 28-cent rise Thursday before falling $1.45, or 2.05%, Friday to close the week at $69.22 and down from $75.56 at last Friday's close. Prices lost 8% for the week, the biggest weekly decline since September 2nd. Natural gas prices followed a similar path on the NYMEX, falling 4 or 5 trading days. Prices opened the week falling 14 cents, fell an additional 13 cents Wednesday, and ended the week falling 8.3 cents to $2.264 per MCF, down from $2.632 at last Friday's close. Still, Morningstar DBRS released a commentary noting that current oil pricing remains favorable and is incentivizing production growth in certain key producing regions, partially offsetting OPEC plus output cuts. Combined with middling growth in global demand, the company says oil prices have largely been capped thus far in 2024. Morningstar DBRS also raised its full year 2025 West Texas Intermediate price forecast to $65 per barrel from $60 per barrel to account for a more favorable full year global oil supply slash demand balance and a greater risk premium related to geopolitical tensions relative to the company's prior forecast. It maintained its 2026 forecast of $60 a barrel and introduced a 2027 forecast of $60 per barrel. Morningstar DBRS also forecasts the U.S. supply and demand balance will gradually tighten as low natural gas prices continue to discourage new production and simultaneously incentivize new demand through 2025. The company maintained its 2025 and 2026 NYMEX price forecasts of $3.25 per MCF in 2025 and $3.50 per MCF in 2026 and introduced a 2027 forecast of $3.50 per MCF. Life Tributes. Donald Earl Weddle, 6/19/1942 to 10/3/2024. Donald Earl Weddle, age 82, of San Antonio, formerly of Midland, Texas, was born June 19, 1942, and passed away peacefully on October 3, 2024, after coping with Parkinson's disease for over 10 years. He was the son of the late Milton and Priscilla Weddle. He was born in Fullerton, California, and raised in Wasco, California. Don was predeceased by his parents, his brother Gerald Weddle, and sister Joan Gertson. He is survived by his loving wife Vivian, son David, Elizabeth, daughter Susan, all of San Antonio, daughter Cynthia Gilbreth, Keith of Midland. He is also survived by grandchildren Todd, Heather of Washington, Gretchen, David of Minnesota, Kiefer, Anna Sophia of San Angelo, Cage, Brady of Fort Worth. In December, he would have been welcoming his first great-granddaughter, Hayes Lee Gilbreth. He is also survived by his brother Andrew Priscilla of California and sister Janet Mies Rick of Idaho, his sister-in-law Linda Weddle of California, numerous nephews and nieces, as well as many cherished friends. A small memorial service is being planned for the end of the month. Heart of Texas Cremations is handling the arrangements. Robert Bob Sidney Dunham, 7/15/1941 to 10/10/2024. Robert Bob Sidney Dunham, 83, of Midland, Texas, passed away peacefully on Thursday, October 10th, with his family by his side after a hard-fought battle with cancer. Bob was born on July 15th, 1941, in Quitaque, Texas, a.k.a. the middle of nowhere, to Voltaire, Leonard, Buster, and Ruth Dunham. Bob is survived by his brothers Daryl Dunham and Rena of Amarillo, Texas, Mickey Dunham and wife Chan of Hobbs, New Mexico, Bill Dunham and wife Sherry of Amarillo, Texas, daughters Ruth Ann Hawks of Midland, Texas, Jennifer Gott and husband David of Bryan, Texas, grandchildren Natalie Farrer and husband Kiefer of Midland, Texas, as well as Caleb Gott and Garrett Gott of Bryan, Texas, and numerous cousins, nephews, and nieces. Bob is preceded in death by his parents, Buster and Ruth Dunham, who were probably wrestling to the front of a long line of recipients for him at the pearly gates. A private celebration of life will be held on his birthday next year. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the American Cancer Society. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Wanda Brown, 7/4/1938 to 9/26/2024. Wanda Joyce Brown, 86, passed away unexpectedly on September 26, 2024 in Louisville, Kentucky. Wanda was born in Snyder, Texas, and grew up in Monahans, Texas, with her four siblings. Wanda was preceded in death by her husband of almost 60 years, her parents, her siblings, and their spouses, Willard and Charlene Gunter, Ray and Louise Gunter, Kitty and Arnold Adams, Betty and Kenneth Alexander. She is survived by her sons Mark Brown of Goleta, California, and David Brown and his wife Susan of Louisville, Kentucky. She is also survived by her beloved granddaughters Julie Miner and her husband Glenn of Louisville, Kentucky, and Natalie Stamm and her husband Henry of Pagosa Springs, Colorado, as well as great-grandchildren Benjamin Miner and Abigail Miner. In addition, she is survived by her sister-in-law Kay Woolheiser of Fort Collins, Colorado, and many treasured nephews and nieces. Francis Sheffield Hilliard Sachs, 10/19/1930 to 10/16/2024. Francis Sheffield Hilliard Sachs was born on October 19, 1930, in Buna, Texas, to James O. and Nancy Jewel Sheffield. She went to be with her Lord and Savior on October 16, 2024. A viewing will be held from 3 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. on Thursday, October 24, 2024, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 o'clock a.m. on Friday, October 25, 2024, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Francis is predeceased by parents James O. Sheffield and Nancy Jewel Sheffield, husband Dr. Joe B. Hilliard, husband Richard B. Sachs, Jr., sister Imogene Sheffield Owen, brother-in-law Ray Owen. She is survived by her three children and their spouses, 10 grandchildren, and 17 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the Alzheimer's Association at http://act.alz.org/donate or a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Tora Baldwin Wilbanks, 1/4/1965 to 10/13/2024. Tora Baldwin Wilbanks, 59, passed away on October 13, 2024 in Midland, Texas. Born on January 4, 1965, Tora grew up on the Navajo Reservation, deeply ingrained with the culture and traditions that shaped her love for nature and all living things. She is survived by her children, Tova Almo Yaklin and husband John, Travis Allen Wilbanks and Taylor Jewel Wilbanks, her parents Evelyn and Thomas Baldwin, and her cherished corgis, Sparky and Billy. She was preceded in death by her sister, Tanya Baldwin, and nephew, Brian. Tora's life will be celebrated on Monday, October 21st, 2024, at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity, located at 1412 West Illinois Avenue, Midland, Texas. In lieu of flowers, contributions in Tora's memory can be made to Alcoholics Anonymous, honoring her commitment to support those in need. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Gilbert Berrigan, 2/14/1948 to 10/14/2024. Gilbert Berrigan was born to Alberto Ybarra Berrigan and Victoria Rodriguez on February 14, 1948 in Comstock, Texas. He passed peacefully on October 14, 2024 in Fisher, Texas. Gilbert is survived by his wife, Brenda Berrigan, and his son, Max Berrigan. He is survived by his sisters, Kathy Oler, Belia Saunders, Lola DeHoyos, and Alicia Robertson, numerous nieces and nephews, and beloved dog, Lola. The life celebration service will be held at Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery in San Antonio, Texas, on Monday, October 28, 2024, at 11:15 a.m. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the Tunnel to Towers. Celebration services are entrusted to Doppenschmidt Funeral Home, 1071 FM 2673, Canyon Lake, Texas, 78133. Please sign the guest book at www.doppenschmidt.com. Paula Huckabee, 8/11/1954 to 10/16/2024, Shreveport. Paula Huckabee passed away Wednesday, October 16, 2024. She was born August 11, 1954 in Shreveport, Louisiana, to George and Dorothy Huckabee. She is survived by her sister, Pam Bird, her brother-in-law, Jim Bird, and her niece, Amy Johnson, and husband, Heath, as well as their children, Lila Claire and Elizabeth May. A memorial service for the family will be held at a later date. John Robert Hayes. John Robert Hayes, 72, passed away on October 11, 2024 in Midland, Texas. A memorial service will be held on October 26, 2024, 2 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Oil report. Atlas Energy's Dune Express nears operation. $400 million conveyor system expected to be completed in December. Construction of the 42-mile electrified conveyor system carrying sand from Atlas Energy Solutions Mine at Kermit into Lee County, New Mexico, is on the verge of becoming operational. The company announced earlier it has begun commissioning of the $400 million Dune Express, with completion expected sometime in December. Quote, "We're wrapping up the construction phase, and we're now installing the electrical equipment," end quote. Kyle Turlington, Vice President, Investor Relations with Atlas, told the Reporter-Telegram. As the electrical equipment is installed, he said the system will be turned on to ensure the motors are running and the parts are moving, and sections of the system will be tested at a time. Quote, "We'll then do a dry commissioning, running the conveyor belt sometime in October or November, and in December we should start running product," end quote, he said. In announcing the commissioning of the Dune Express and providing a third quarter operational update, John Turner, President and Chief Executive Officer, commented, quote, "We are just months away from beginning to realize our goal of taking thousands of trucks off public roads, making the Permian Basin a safer, more reliable, and environmentally cleaner place to live and work," end quote. Because of the issues with the Kermit facility that prompted a rebuild that was completed in July, Atlas expects higher plant operating expenses to cause third quarter 2024 operating results to fall below prior guidance. The company now expects third quarter 2024 revenue will be between $300 and $310 million. Propant sales volumes are expected to be approximately 6 million tons. The company also expects to book an asset write-down of approximately $9 million related to damage to a new dredge at the Kermit mine that resulted in a total loss. The second dredge is operating and feeding the plant at reduced levels. Those issues having been addressed, Turlington told the Reporter-Telegram, and Atlas expects to exit the year with normal expenses. Occidental invests $1 billion in carbon capture plant. Most energy companies, whether voluntarily or compelled by regulations, are working to reduce emissions from their operations. Occidental Petroleum has invested about $1 billion in its Stratos Direct air capture plant, currently under construction in Ettrick County. The plant, designed to capture 500,000 tons of carbon dioxide per year, is on target to be commercially operational by mid-2025. Quote, "The challenge with new technology and getting the pilot project off the ground is beginning construction," end quote. Monacy Scott, net zero development lead with Occidental, told members of the Permian Basin chapter, Society of Petroleum Engineers, and UTPB engineering students at a membership luncheon this week. That removed carbon can either be stored or used in enhanced oil recovery projects, she said. That would make low carbon oil available for market, she added. According to Scott, there are 60 million tons per annum of industrial carbon dioxide emissions in the Permian area, located near CO2 infrastructure and CO2 demand. She further estimated 60% of U.S. emissions are concentrated in 13 geographic areas and hubs with carbon capture projects. Occidental is committed to converting from natural CO2 to anthropogenic CO2, CO2 captured from current and future industrial sources. That, quote, would unlock 2 billion barrels of recoverable oil remaining, increasing U.S. energy security, end quote, she said. CO2 enhanced oil recovery has been deployed since the 1970s, and Scott said multiple companies have Environmental Protection Agency approved monitoring, reporting, and verification plans for CO2 EOR. This shows CO2 can be safely and securely stored, she said. Permian Basin refineries to use net zero emissions technology. Farm to table has been a growing trend in the restaurant industry as chefs and diners seek fresh, locally sourced foods. Wellbore to gas tank could soon become a trend in the Permian Basin as a new collaboration aims to construct one or more hydrocarbon processing plants in the Permian Basin. Clean Refineries, Inc. of Edmond, Oklahoma, and Permian Energy Partners of Midland plan to bring Clean Refineries' proprietary net zero emissions technology, ZNET, to two proposed sites, one in Odessa's Industrial Park area and the other between Stanton and Big Spring. Plans are for the two facilities to process 20,000 barrels of crude per day, scalable to 100,000 barrels per day. Quote, "One of the biggest issues with refining today is refineries are the third largest contributors of greenhouse gas," end quote, said David Fowler, president of Permian Energy Partners. Quote, "There are 129 refineries in the U.S., 30 in Texas, mostly on the Gulf Coast, and 3 in the Permian Basin," end quote. Those 3, in Big Spring and in Artesia and Lovington, New Mexico, process less than 200,000 barrels per day combined. Quote, "The Permian Basin produces over 6 million barrels," end quote, he said. Fowler also pointed out the cost of transporting crude from the Permian Basin to refineries and then bringing back the refined product. Quote, "We feel strongly the product should be refined here," end quote, he said. Derek Williamson, chief executive officer of Clean Refineries, said the closed-looped process uses a flash-to-vacuum separation technology. The system mists the oil into droplets that are then flashed to vapors, and those vapors are one of the separation points. Quote, diesel, naphtha, gasoline, jet fuel will be more defined, end quote, he said. The two said each reactor can process 3,400 barrels per day of feedstock ranging from 8 to 50 gravity, and there will be multiple reactors at each site. They also stressed the cleanliness of the technology, noting that a traditional refinery processing 150,000 barrels per day emits 2,041 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year, compared to the ZNET facility that emits 3.6 metric tons from a 150,000 barrels per day facility. For further comparison, a typical four-person home emits 6.3 metric tons of CO2 per year. In addition to supplying diesel, gasoline, and other products, the partnership intends to produce sustainable aviation fuel. The facilities can be built on a much smaller footprint and in a smaller time frame at a lower cost, estimated at about $280 million. But the real benefit is the jobs, Fowler and Williamson said. It's estimated each facility will create 80 primary and 300 to 450 ancillary jobs with payroll over $6 million a year. Quote, I love this idea. It's green. There's no competition. We're not stepping on anyone's toes. Because the industry has a black eye from refining, this gives a green solution we've not had before. And this isn't cyclical with oil prices, end quote. Williamson agreed. Quote, our market won't be determined by oil prices. Our margins will remain the same, end quote. Williamson reported the company is in talks with the state of Louisiana on a 20,000-barrel facility to produce marine-grade bunker fuel. The company is also in talks with the city of Kennedy, Texas, for a 30,000-barrel facility that would help provide fuel for municipal fleets. There are also talks about a 10,000-barrel-per-day facility in southwest Wyoming. Kinder Morgan expands Gulf Coast Express pipeline for Permian gas. Moving natural gas out of the Permian Basin will face one less roadblock after Kinder Morgan decided to expand its Gulf Coast Express pipeline. The company announced it has reached a final investment decision to proceed with the $455 million expansion project, of which $161 million will be Kinder Morgan's share. After securing binding firm long-term transportation agreements, the expansion will increase natural gas deliveries by 570 million cubic feet per day from the Permian Basin to South Texas markets. It is expected to be in service by mid-2026. Kinder Morgan is operator of the pipeline, which it jointly owns through a subsidiary along with an affiliate of ArcLight Capital Partners and a subsidiary of Phillips 66. In addition to the Gulf Coast Express, Kinder Morgan is boosting its natural gas operations in the southern U.S., announcing several other projects. Preliminary survey work is being done on the South System Expansion 4, designed to south line capacity by 1.2 billion cubic feet. The $3 billion project will meet growing generation and local distribution company demand in Southeast markets. Construction's activities also ongoing in the $154 million South Texas to Houston market expansion project on the Kinder Morgan Tejas pipeline. The first phase will add compression on the main line, and the second phase will involve 14 miles of looping. Together, they will provide approximately 500 million cubic feet per day to key markets. Construction is also ongoing on the second phase of the $670 million Evangeline Pass project, which will modify and enhance systems in Mississippi and Louisiana, delivering 2 billion cubic feet per day to Venture Global's Plaquemines LNG facility. Chief Executive Officer Kim Deng said during the company's recent third quarter earnings call that, quote, discussions around opportunities related to significant new natural gas demand for electric generation associated with coal conversions and power plants, artificial intelligence operations, cryptocurrency mining, data centers, and industrial reshoring also continued during the quarter. And now we see an opportunity set well in excess of 5 BCF/D in that area, end quote. Community. Meet the Robnettes, a family of 14 children, 4 dogs, and 2 cats. When Oliver Robnett makes lunch for his siblings. He makes 11 sandwiches. Quote, we go through a loaf of bread each day, end quote, he said. Quote, it's pretty wild around my house. There are a total of 14 children, including me. I'm the third oldest. My two older sisters are no longer living in the house, but my parents have a long way to go before the youngest, who is 4, leaves the house, end quote. Robnett's parents, Dyla and the Honorable Jeff Robnett, adopted most of the children. Oliver is one of only 3 biological children. The Robnetts first adopted the child of a friend's wife's sister who couldn't keep the baby. They since have continued to adopt children who need homes. In a January 2023 interview with News West 9, Judge Robnett said that he sees the results of children who grew up without a family in his courtroom every day and that it's not a good thing. During the same interview, Dyla said that after the couple adopted their first child, God led them to adopt more. Some of their adopted children are biological siblings, and the Robnetts said that they felt compelled to keep brothers and sisters together. So there are currently 13 people living in the 2-story house, along with 4 dogs and 2 cats. Quote, it never seemed odd to me, end quote. 19-year-old Oliver said, quote, when people find out I have 13 brothers and sisters and they start asking me questions, I realize that it probably is a little strange. We all have our assigned responsibilities and take turns helping around the house. For example, I don't make 11 sandwiches every night for the next day. We have a sandwich-making schedule, end quote. Oliver is a 2023 graduate of Midland High School and graduated in the top 10% of his class. He is currently in his second year at Midland College pursuing a business degree. Quote, I chose business because I like math and want a degree that encompasses a broad range of career possibilities, end quote, he said. Quote, there's a lot a person can do with a degree in business, end quote. Oliver's reasoning is backed by statistics. According to a recent Job Outlook survey from the National Association of Colleges and Employers, 8 out of the top 10 degrees in demand with employers right now are under the business umbrella. These degrees include finance and accounting, marketing, business, management, and more. While Oliver isn't sure exactly what specific business discipline he would like to consider, he is certain that he wants to stay in the area and complete a Bachelor's of Business Administration degree at the University of Texas Permian Basin or remain at Midland College and work toward a Bachelor of Applied Science degree in Organizational Management. He is currently attending Midland College through financial assistance from donor-directed scholarships and is on track to graduate with an associate degree this coming May. Quote, right now I'm leaning toward going into public service after I get a bachelor's degree, end quote, Oliver said. Quote, I've lived in Midland most of my life and want to do something where I can be of service to the community, end quote. In his spare time, Oliver enjoys playing the guitar and the bass guitar. He said that he wants to learn to play the keyboard and hopes to be able to take a music theory class as an elective while he is at Midland College. Other favorite pastimes are doing yard work, especially tending to his garden, playing video games, and just being with his family, which he said is a good thing because there's not much chance for being alone in the house.
Mean girls take over Permian High School. Yes, you can't sit with them. The Permian High School Theater cast invites the public to watch their version of the Broadway musical Mean Girls. Shows are scheduled for 7:30 p.m. October the 24th and 2:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. October the 26th at the Permian High School Theater. General admission tickets are $15 and ECISD staff and student tickets are $10. No pink is required to attend. I love the musical and I think it's a lot of fun, Permian Theater Director Scott Winham said. I love the movie. It's got a lot of nostalgia and we've got some strong females in this program. Based on the Broadway musical itself, based on the hit 2004 film, the Permian version of Mean Girls has been in the works before falling into Winham's hands. The musical follows Katie Heron as she navigates public high school for the first time. Joining a group called The Plastics, the show hits on themes of friendship, betrayal, and dealing with peer pressure. I think people love Mean Girls so much because it's relatable, Winham said. 2 decades after the film's release, it has become a cult classic and a staple of pop culture. Here's what FEMA does and doesn't do. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is tasked with helping states and communities hit by disasters like Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton. There are a lot of misperceptions about FEMA's role in disaster recovery, what it does and does not pay for, and what residents in hurricane-hit areas can expect. Here's a closer look. What does FEMA do, and where does it get its money? FEMA has an operating budget and a disaster relief fund. The fund gets replenished every year by Congress and is used to pay for recovery from hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, and other disasters. FEMA also pays for rebuilding from past disasters and for projects designed to protect communities against further calamity. This is kind of like the emergency account for the country, said Samantha L. Montano, an assistant professor of emergency management at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. Congress recently replenished the fund with $20 billion, the same amount FEMA got last year. About $8 billion of that is set aside for recovery from previous storms and mitigation projects. The federal government doesn't help with every disaster. It generally has to be above the ability of a community or state to handle. In that case, the governor or tribunal authority asks the president for an emergency declaration. Once declared, FEMA assistance varies widely. Public assistance, which is a lot of what it pays for, is geared toward reimbursing governments for debris removal or rebuilding roads, public buildings, and more. FEMA also has individual assistance designed to help residents. This can include one-time payments for emergency needs up to a trailer for someone who lost their house. But experts stress that the federal agency isn't in charge of the entire process. Everybody thinks that FEMA just comes in right after the disaster and starts managing the entire disaster. And that's just not the case, said Brock Long, who was FEMA administrator from 2017 to 2019. What happens when the disaster fund runs low? The disaster assistance fund sometimes runs low in late summer before Congress passes a new budget. When that happens, FEMA shifts to what's called immediate needs funding. That means the agency stops paying out for previous disasters and conserves its money for life-saving missions during any new ones. When the disaster relief fund is replenished, like what just happened in September, then money will flow again to longer-term projects. Honestly, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to streamline it and rethink. How can a disaster relief fund be set up in a manner where the FEMA administrator is not constantly having to ask for supplemental funding? Long said, "Will FEMA give me enough to rebuild?" No, it's important to know not just what FEMA does, but what it doesn't do, especially for individuals. One claim floating around after Helene is that disaster survivors only get $750 from FEMA. That figure refers to help that the agency can give someone in an affected area for what they might need immediately, like clothing or food, Keith Turry, acting director of FEMA's Office of Response and Recovery, said. From there, the agency can provide other things like money for storage unit, medical bills, or rental assistance, depending on the situation. For homeowners, the first line of defense is always insurance. Those who don't have insurance or not enough can turn to FEMA. But the maximum amount someone can get to rebuild is $42,500. That's a far cry from what is needed to fix severe damage or rebuild completely. This is one of the kind of major problems FEMA has in terms of how the public understands their role and responsibility, said Montano. FEMA does not make anybody whole after a disaster happens. They are not going to give you enough money to completely recover your life. Paul's escape showed power through weakness. The Apostle Paul always inculcated the spiritual strength of first century Christians, but he had to rely on their physical strength when they lowered him in a basket from the high wall of Damascus to escape the governor who had ordered his arrest. The Reverend Daniel Perez, Spanish language pastor of the Odessa Bible Church, said communist terrorists kidnapped him and a number of other people from a children's Bible camp in Venezuela and later threatened to kill him and his wife and baby daughter because he was espousing the gospel. We felt like Paul in the basket because we had to run away and escape with our lives, the Reverend Perez said. If you truly believe in Jesus, you have to be ready to experience those situations of being unsafe and feeling at risk. God bless the United States of America. Minister Greg Fleming of the Downtown Church of Christ in Midland cited 2 Corinthians to say Paul combated Corinthian critics who claimed, based on earthly wisdom, that he was too weak to be a good missionary. Paul does this by emphasizing that his clay jar approach to ministry makes it clear that he relies on God's surpassing power rather than his own ability, Fleming said. A cross-based ministry looks to Jesus, who was crucified in weakness but lives by the power of God. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4. Sandwiched within Paul's essay on not boasting is what is sometimes spoken of as his fool's speech, which he concludes by boasting about his weakness, the minister said. His story of being lowered from a window in the high Damascus wall in a basket at night fits this theme, Fleming said. This ignoble account of slipping out of town on the sly is the opposite of common ancient hero stories depicting a brave soldier who is first over the wall to conquer a city. In my view, this story illustrates his theme of power in weakness. Paul said, that is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Following the 11th chapter of 2 Corinthians is Paul's account of aversion in chapter 12, verses 2 through 4. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from his body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible things, things no one is permitted to tell. Obituaries. Alfredo Espinosa, age 80, passed away on July the 3rd. Memorial services will be Wednesday, October the 23rd, at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church in Odessa. Rosary at 10:30 a.m. and Mass at 11 a.m. and Saturday, October the 26th, at Our Lady of Peace Catholic Church in Alpine. Rosary at 9:30 a.m. and Mass at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at Holy Angel Cemetery. Luncheon will follow both services. Curtis Lee Dixon, age 81, of Odessa, died Wednesday, October the 16th, in Odessa. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. October the 26th at Middessa Heights Baptist Church. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Armando Ramon, 92, of Odessa, died Wednesday, October the 16th, in Odessa. Memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. October the 19th at Kingdom Hall of Jehovah Witnesses. Arrangements are by American Heritage Funeral Home of Midland. Dear Abby, after a lonely post-divorce decade, I have found a loving man whom I'll call Drew. We share many of the same interests and values and are enjoying this second chance at love and romance. We spend time at each other's homes, and my grown kids like having him around. The challenge is the erratic and angry behavior of his 27-year-old son, Adam, who lives in the building my boyfriend owns and resides in. Adam was previously diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Drew now says the diagnosis was inaccurate, and Adam is learning how to deal with his emotions without heavy medication. Abby, Adam has never held a job and manages only one junior college class a semester in his quest to enter a four-year university. The balance of his time is spent gaming with online friends and complaining about neighbors who rent in the building. I have witnessed his disturbing and angry behavior and have made clear I will remove myself from the drama should things get heated in my presence. What I'm struggling with is the passive way Drew is managing Adam's bullying and negative behavior. When Adam acts out, Drew is often sworn at, derided, manipulated, and disrespected. The codependence and enabling in his father-son relationship prevents any chance of Adam attaining an independent life. Drew becomes very defensive when I speak about his son, and there is rarely agreement about how to handle a particular outburst. I'm not sure I can manage a future with him if his son comes as a package deal. Should I stay or should I go? And Dear Abby responds, "Face it, Drew's mentally challenged son is part of a package deal. Your boyfriend has no intention of changing the dynamic between him and Adam because, unpleasant as it sometimes is, he won't shoulder the responsibility of being tough enough on him to assign him more responsibility and less gaming time." How sad for all three of you. If you are satisfied with the status quo, you should stay. However, if you would like to be married and move in with Drew, I don't think it's in the cards, and you should step out of the picture. And another Dear Abby problem. "Dear Abby, I really like this guy. He makes me so happy. He told me he is attracted to me, but he doesn't want a relationship with me. When we spend time together, we always have a great time. But when I reach out to him, he doesn't always respond right away. But he treats me wonderfully when he does. I really want us to date, not have a relationship, just date. How can I tell him that?" Dear Abby responds, "This guy may have the same thing in mind as you do. There may be reasons you should be aware of as to why he doesn't always respond to you in a timely fashion. He may need to concentrate on school, his job, or another girlfriend. It would be in your best interest to know why. Since you would be willing to date him under the circumstances you described, speak up and see how he reacts. You can contact Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.